Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Last fall, most of us watched in horror as the stock market tanked. Some stayed in the game hoping for a Hail Mary pass. Others stepped to the sidelines, and they still have not returned to the field.
If you think about months and months of people running in abject panic, that adds up, I'm sure, easily to hundreds of billions of dollars.
We'll look at what they've missed out on since then. Plus, meet one family that went from extreme frugal to nothing. Spending nothing, not one penny for a month.
It was a big mistake. The milk ran out by like day five.
Some parts of the experiment did work. We'll hear about them. And thankfully, most kids don't think about their family's finances. But deciding what to do with an allowance can be an emotional roller coaster.
I saved, I spent. And I did that for a while.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. What were you doing at this time a year ago? Well, you were probably watching as central banks around the world issued emergency cuts in interest rates. Germany said it would guarantee all money in its citizens' checking and savings accounts to avoid a run on the banks. The Dow sank below 10,000 for the first time since 2004. 1 year and a stock market rally hence, we're still waiting for another shoe. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today.
For the bulk of the last year, the stock market looked as sorry as a cat stuck in the rain. But around springtime, things started to change. No less a luminary than Fed Chief Ben Bernanke has declared the recession essentially over. And since March, stocks are up more than 50%. And yet, a recent poll from the American Association of Individual Investors found that 45% of its members still consider this a bear market. They're staying away. For some perspective, we turn to Bob Frick of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
Can you give us some idea of how much involvement investors have in the stock market at this point? How much skin is in the game?
A lot less than there was a year ago. A lot of people got out and stayed out, and of course, they're the ones who are kicking themselves. By some estimates, as much as $40 billion is sitting on the sidelines, and that's obviously a very conservative estimate.
What amount of money left the market a year ago?
If you're talking about individual investors, there is no question that there was a mass exodus of the market that started in October, and the exodus actually continued pretty much through March and April. So, you know, if you think about months and months of people running in abject panic, that adds up, I'm sure, easily to hundreds of billions of dollars.
So apparently none of us have learned the lesson that you're not supposed to buy high and sell low.
Right. And, you know, we just had this lesson in 2000
right,
with the tech bubble. But people gradually got back in. You know, the housing bubble made people feel wealthier than obviously they actually were. Their fear disappeared. And as they got more excited, what happens in investor psychology tells us is that people, when they lose their inhibitions, they start taking on more risk and it seems normal to them. Then the big crash comes and they're kicking themselves.
The market bottomed in what, February?
I think it was March 9th.
March? Okay. So there was talk at that time that perhaps this was the bottom. People should be buying into the market now. How do folks know whether to believe that kind of thing as it's happening?
Well, I think the important thing is that you don't believe anything as it's happening. Nobody can tell when the market's, you know, is at its peak or mm-hmm. at its low. And people who think that they can always fool themselves into buying high and selling low. The bottom line is, in the financial markets, only the long, long term is what you can count on.
I find it interesting that it's not just individual investors who have been sitting on the sidelines. A large money management firm recently advised its clients to lower their stock allocation. I suppose the distrust and the cautiousness is everywhere.
Right. Basically, the pain of loss is higher than the pleasure of gain. This is something that's been proven over and over again in studies.
And money managers are not immune to it.
Exactly. They're human like everyone else. And not only do they feel the pain of the loss of, you know, their own portfolios, but they have all of their customers who are, you know, heaping scorn and abuse upon them. So, you know, when you look at it from that point of view, maybe we were just too pumped up a year ago. And now we're kind of getting back to what's reality. People, I think, now are getting back to reality. The thing I worry about is, in a couple years, the market's going to start edging up. There's going to be a new boom that's going to come along. And we're going to forget that these big losses can happen. And there's no reason to think that they're not going to be happening more frequently, given everything that's going on in the financial sector these days.
Bob Frick is a senior editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Hi, you're so welcome.
Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
Employees across the country are going through open enrollment season right now. Time to sort out your HSAs from your 401ks and FSAs. Healthcare is always the big headache. How much do you need? What kind? What format? And that's part of why we're having this big national debate over healthcare reform. But if there is one complaint common to all of us lucky enough to have health insurance, it's another element of alphabet soup, the EOB. It's an explanation of benefits form that you get after visits to the doctor. And as Tamara Keith reports, it needs a whole lot of explaining itself.
I got an explanation of benefits in the mail the other day, opened it up, and had no idea what it was trying to tell me. An EOB is the statement insurance companies send you after your doctor sends them a bill. It tells you what the claim was for, what was covered, what you owe, and why. So I took my EOB right to the source.
I'm Michael Sullivan. I'm Director of Communications for CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield.
That's my insurance company. The explanation of benefits I show him is related to a biopsy of a bump on my head. Don't worry, I'm fine. At the bottom of the page, it says in all caps, this is not a bill. But it also lists a bunch of dollar figures. One line is for the total charges, $259. The next line says less non-allowed amount, and that's $189. This is where it gets confusing.
I don't think that it's uncommon for people to take a look at it and say, wow, is this a bill? There's $189 that it says wasn't paid by the insurance company. What you want to look for is, what are you responsible for?
In this case, the total patient responsibility is listed as $0. Phew. But why all those different numbers? The total charges are what the doctor, or in this case, the lab, charges. That's their list price. But the insurance company doesn't pay that. Sullivan says they've negotiated a lower payment in advance.
The non-allowed amount is the difference between what the doctor charges and what the health insurance company pays.
The bump on my head wasn't very complicated, and neither was my EOB. Most EOBs are much more confusing, with lines for co-payments and co-insurance and unmet deductibles. If the patient sees a doctor out of network, it gets really messy. Forget it if you have a hospital stay.
I don't know. It makes doing your taxes look kind of easy. Dealing with your insurance forms when you're sick is... it's really hard.
Karen Politz is a health policy researcher at Georgetown. Years ago, she needed surgery. Her insurance company pre-approved it. Then she got an EOB saying the operation wasn't covered.
It took me several weeks to figure out that the reason the service wasn't paid was that the hospital had put the wrong code on it, and, well, that's not what had been pre-authorized, and so it kicked out.
Politz says a lot of people toss their EOBs when they should use them to track their deductibles and bills.
What I've said to my mom, my friends, is, you know, keep everything, pay nothing. Keep all of your statements, keep all of the bills, match them up, and go back and check the work.
Paulet says the forms can be nearly impossible to decipher. If a claim is denied, you have to wade through an alphabet soup of codes to figure out why.
There should be sort of a very clear trail of breadcrumbs about what you asked for, what was covered, what was paid, what was not paid, and why. And in English would be nice.
I think that there's a clear understanding among our members that the EOB needs to be improved.
Susan Pisano is with America's Health Insurance Plans, the major trade group for insurance companies.
We would like to see there be a standard. We certainly want that standard to be done in a way that is clear, useful, easy to act on for consumers.
But when it comes to healthcare these days, nothing seems easy. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith from Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, most insurance forms, not just EOBs, are complicated to say the least. I've generally chucked mine into the recycle bin after making sure that even though on the first page it says I owe, two pages later, it says I don't. But in some cases, it can be extremely important to hold on to all that paperwork. You never know when you're going to need it. And that's something commentator Julia Barton experienced firsthand.
Many parents have scrapbooks of their children's first years. I have the box in the basement. It contains hundreds of pages, one of them a financial questionnaire. My arithmetic was bad because I filled out the form while in a neonatal intensive care unit. My newborn son was before me on a gurney, being pierced with intravenous tubes. I just found out that he has a serious birth defect and must be flown to a larger city for surgery to save his life. I felt like fainting, but there was more paperwork to do. Some for the air ambulance, some to apply for indigent care in case my insurance policy wasn't enough. It wasn't. My son survived the operation, and I'm grateful for the compassionate medical team. When we took him home after a month, the bills were waiting. He needed medicine and frequent trips to the doctor, and I needed an insurance broker. During the baby's every nap, I was on the phone with her or the insurance company or some billing office. As my son grew, he had more surgeries, and 3 years later, the box was filled with paper. His birth defect will never go away, but thanks to medical expertise, it's a manageable part of our lives. Still, I hang on to the box. Why? Well, there was that collection agency from the air ambulance company. They started calling more than 2 years after the date of service. They never billed my insurance. It took an attorney from the state's indigent care program, plus all my documentation, to get them to back down. The box feels like a way to contain the nightmare through simple record keeping. All the talk of healthcare reform got me to open it up again, and then I realized the extent of my delusion. The protagonist of Franz Kafka's The Trial spends the whole novel thinking he can game the system to find out the charges against him and get them dismissed. But in the end, Joseph K. is still trapped in an absurd place between hope and despair, as is everyone with a pre-existing condition, as are all parents with a box like mine. So I close it up and head outside with my children while the sun is shining.
Julia Barton is a freelance writer in St. Paul, Minnesota. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. How do you get up the nerve to start your own business? Well, for one guy, it began with an ultimatum from an investor.
Show me that, you know, you're really in this thing and withdraw from Harvard Business School, and then we'll put the money in.
Think you know what he decided to do? Find out next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, I think there is a hidden inventor entrepreneur in all of us. I've had this brilliant invention in my head for years. It's a remote pooper scooper. So when we're on walks, my hands won't even touch the plastic bag containing my dog's waste product. Of course, as I was reminding myself of this awesome and revolutionary idea this week, I decided to Google remote pooper scooper, and I found out someone else has already created one. Well, our next story is about an entrepreneur who went for it. He had a great idea for a product, made it happen, and now makes a lot of money off of it. Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
That's the second gong of the day at GoMobo headquarters. The gong rings every time there's a big piece of good news at the company.
I am gonging because we have been officially accepted as an iPhone developer.
Dave Fellows is one of 10 employees at GoMobo. He works for 28-year-old Noah Glass, who started the company 4 years ago. Glass gave me a quick tour of his office in Soho.
We're upstairs now. We've got sort of an open seating plan. This used to be an art gallery. It's got very high ceilings.
It's a two-story loft. The basement, where the gong is, also has a foosball table, a dartboard, and a small conference room.
And we have our desks set up across from one another. We've got about 5 desks per wall.
Raised outside of Boston, Glass is every bit the New England boy. He's got short red hair, blue eyes, and he's the only one in the office wearing a sport coat. He's even got a handkerchief in his pocket, like any good CEO. He looks relaxed, but maybe he's just tired.
I'd say that I've been working 100-hour weeks every week for the last 4 years.
And with a work ethic like that, it won't surprise you what he's been working on. GoMobo is a website that's meant to save you time ordering takeout food. You order online or on your phone, pay in advance, and skip the lines when you go pick it up. It doesn't cost anything for you, the customer. Glass and his company collect fees from participating restaurants.
Well, so right now we're at around 500 restaurants, but we're going to end this year at 5,000 restaurants.
And GoMobo will be making a profit at 3,500, he says. The huge jump in numbers is due to deals with Subway, Burger King, Dunkin' Donuts, and a couple of other soon-to-be-announced chains. Up till now, the company's been running on investor support. Primarily from a wealthy venture capitalist Glass showed the idea to just before he was supposed to start attending Harvard Business School. This was the guy's response.
Show me that you're really in this thing and withdraw from Harvard Business School, and then we'll put the money in.
So Glass traded his potential Harvard degree for a whole lot of takeout food.
I'm going to log in and register, which is how I sign into my account.
Glass pulls out his BlackBerry to show me how the product works.
I will get a 6-inch turkey breast fresh value meal.
Just to test things out, I'll order the old-fashioned way, by standing in line when we get to the restaurant.
That lettuce, tomato, green peppers.
Glass picks his order up, already paid for, about 30 seconds after we walk in the door. And when I finally sit down at the table, he says,
5 minutes, right there.
5 minutes, you've been sitting here, your sandwich is getting cold.
That's right, but you don't have a drink yet either.
I still have to go get a drink. All right, let me do that. All right.
Okay, so it works, or at least restaurants large and small seem to think so. But how common is this kind of entrepreneurial success? What does it take? I asked Rod Kurtz, senior editor of Inc. magazine.
It's not good enough to just have an idea. It's not good enough just to work hard. It's where the two intersect. That's where you find the real success stories.
It's the combination of innovation, smarts, hard work, and competitiveness, he says, and confidence. What it takes to do some of the things Noah Glass has done in his life. Bike across the country, move to South Africa to work for a company that helps business startups, abandon a budding career playing lacrosse, and oh yeah, throw Harvard Business School out the window to start a company.
They're so confident about their ideas, and I think that's what separates really successful entrepreneurs from the ones that the idea never leaves the kitchen table. It's getting out there, it's making the next step and actually executing, and the ones that do it are often the ones we read and hear about.
But from the super confident Noah Glass, this word of warning for all you would-be entrepreneurs.
Invariably, you have a whole set of assumptions when you're starting a business, and every single one of them is slightly wrong. I think the maturity that you need as an entrepreneur is to reassess those assumptions almost daily while maintaining this great faith in the vision.
And to keep you awake during those 100-hour work weeks, make sure you've got a gong on hand. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
It's that part of the show where we take your questions, and hopefully you've got a lot of them for us. We're looking forward to them, and I'm joined this week by David Lazarus, who writes a consumer column for the Los Angeles Times. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tess.
We have got Hannah on the phone. She's in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
And how can we help you out today?
Well, I have a question about contesting IRS tax assessments.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
David, does anyone ever want to go up against the IRS?
Well, that's a big dog to fight, but you got to do it because, let's face it, the IRS is not perfect as much as the IRS would have you think so.
So, Hannah, in this case, how are they not perfect?
Well, I have a partner named Amy who has an ex named Jill, who reported in December of 2006 a $6,000 payment from Jill to Amy. Amy did not get the money since they were already apart. And Jill does have some credibility problems with the law, and I wonder if that matters and how we can contest that.
Oh, Hannah, is there a possibility that a check was sent out and for some reason it just didn't get through?
Not really.
So you're saying that, that essentially an expenditure that was claimed by Jill did not get to Amy?
That's what I'm saying.
All right.
Well, so how do you prove that a check was never issued in cash? I suppose that it would be the cashing end, wouldn't it? If Amy never cashed a check that Jill says that she sent her, she never got the money, right?
All right. Here's the crux of this is the allegation is one of tax fraud. Because if Jill is claiming some sort of expenditure, probably for tax purposes, that she never made, well, the IRS looks askance at that sort of thing. And so the heart of this is going to be tax fraud, which is a very serious allegation, Hannah. So, you know, keep that in mind that we're talking about alleged crimes before you go further down this road. But if Amy wants to make sure that she's protected, that there's not going to be any sort of tax liability for her, there is a mechanism for this. And you can do it online or in an office. And the way to tackle this is you go first to the IRS.gov website. And that's, of course, the home base online of the IRS. Uh-huh. And you can find a link there for appeals. And that's where you're going to be wanting to take this, because essentially Amy is going to be appealing some sort of tax liability for herself. She has nothing to fear, nothing to worry about. So you contact the IRS with a good, strong heart and you lay it all out for them and let them carry the ball. The most important thing, though, is bring them into the loop. Once you get the wheel spinning, then you have now pointed all the attention back at Jill, which is, let's face it, that's where you want the attention.
All right.
And as David said, show them your heart.
Yes. Be good. They like that. They like being good.
The kinder, gentler side. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And next we have Lorena on the phone in Yarnell, Arizona. Hi, Lorena.
Good morning.
How are things in Arizona?
Wonderful.
Yeah? Well, what's your question for us?
My brother is disabled. He's a cancer survivor and suffers chronic depression.
Oh.
He had excellent credit. But about a year ago, he received numerous offers from Freedom Debt Relief Management to reduce his debts by negotiating lower interest rates. They promised to manage and pay his bills, none of which they've done. 9 months later, his creditors, Chase and Capital One, are pressuring him. His credit is shot. And I would like to know how he might go about recovering his funds, as well as restoring his credit.
Boy, David, sounds like this Freedom credit relief didn't provide much freedom.
Well, you know, Tess, a lot of people in this recession have gone down this road. So here's another question I want to ask you, Lorena. Did your when your brother was approached by these credit repair, credit salvaging services, did he pay any money up front to the company?
I think the amount was over $200, around $250.
Well, you know, I got to say, he got off easy. In fact, in many cases, they charge as much as $3,000. Now, let me tell you right here, state attorneys general across the country have issued warnings about these services. Maybe they'll make a cursory phone call or two, but that's it. And then you are still in the same hot water that you've been in before. Don't even go there. If a company asks for money up front, it's not a company you want to be doing business with.
But unfortunately, it sounds like her brother has already gone into business with them. So where can he go for help?
Lorena, your brother's got two problems. First of all, he paid the few hundred bucks to the service. He should kiss that goodbye. He's just not going to see that again. Now he needs to worry about the actual problem. And that is he's got this debt and he's got a lot of creditors breathing down his neck. What does he do? And the trick here is approaching the creditors and letting them know, I want to give you money. I am not going to file bankruptcy if I can avoid it, but I need some help in paying off this debt. Either the interest rate is too high or I need more time to do it. Creditors will negotiate, especially in a time like this. And you've got two options here. You can either deal with them directly or you contact a credit counseling service. You can find them online. They will act on your behalf as a mediator.
And we generally tend to recommend that you try to go with someone affiliated with the National Federation for Credit Counseling.
Precisely. They need to be licensed if they're going to be upstanding. And here's the same rule. Any credit counselor who asks for money up front is not a credit counselor you want to be dealing with. Only deal with a credit counselor who seeks no money from you in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. David, you know, I think the lesson here really is that you can repair your credit on your own, or perhaps with the help of a nonprofit organization. But these folks who are advertising all over the internet, all over television, saying we can repair your credit score, we can work with your creditors, run.
More often than not, these guys are bottom feeders and they are parasites. And that's why you want to keep those guys at arm's length and do the legwork yourself.
All right. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Can you imagine trying to go a whole month without spending any money? Not one lousy penny? Well, W. Hodding Carter's family did it, or at least they came pretty close. Carter's been writing a column for Gourmet Magazine, I should say the late, great Gourmet Magazine, about his family's year-long experiment with extreme frugality at their home in Maine. You've heard a couple of his commentaries about the experience on this show, but we wanted to talk to him about this, what would you call it, crazy idea to abstain from all spending? Hodding Carter, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tess. Thanks.
So before we hear about a month without spending, I do want to ask for your thoughts about the demise of Gourmet, which was posting your blog entries. What do you do now?
We found out on Monday, I think the same, a few hours after the staff did. But by midnight, Monday night, my wife had created a website for me, and I'd written a blog by, I think, by 1 a.m. So I don't know what, I just got worried that we were going to lose this chance to keep talking about and sharing all our mishaps with trying to change the way we've been living. And so we just, it's just been a crazy couple of days.
Well, and so how does that affect your frugality when you now have to have your own website?
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's not really costing that much. I found that, I think, the cheapest host company out there, which maybe wasn't a good idea. If anyone goes to my website now, they're going, okay, sometimes it's not good to be frugal. But I'm hoping someone has mercy on me and helps me figure this out.
All right. Well, for the past year, you've been living on a shoestring budget, but recently the family went way beyond frugal chic that we've been hearing about, or even extreme frugality, to spending nothing. So tell us, how and why did this idea pop into your head?
Well, I felt like we were sometimes doing well, sometimes not. The summer, really, things got out of hand because my family was always coming in and wanting us to do things. And so we definitely didn't do it in July and August. This is the first time I'm admitting this, so I don't feel too comfortable. But
that's
anyway.
Okay. Nobody's listening.
Okay, good. I said, okay, how can we really make this happen? Oh, just don't spend any money. I convinced Lisa. And
Lisa's your wife, right?
Right. Everyone should just read the old blogs to find out all about it. And we decided that it would be cheating if we went out and bought all we needed for the whole month, even though we bought like a couple extra gallons of milk, and we loaded up both cars with gas. And we just set out to try to make it really work for once. And it was a big mistake.
Uh-oh.
Well, just the milk ran out by like day five.
I was wondering about that. I mean, wouldn't it be outdated as well, at least by the end of the month?
Yeah, but you know, the kids wouldn't know. I could just come. No. But we, I couldn't believe 3 gallons of milk in 5 days, and none of my kids drink milk.
What happened there?
They saw that there wasn't a whole lot in the house and they weren't going to get anything, so they were loading up on their calories, putting chocolate milk for you. No, one of my son does drink it. But what was really cool was that somehow we put out there that, you know, what we were doing to our friends, and all of a sudden everyone wanted to barter.
Yeah.
And
you know, I read about that on your website, and I mean, this goes back eons that this is how people got things for themselves, was bartering, and you seem to have brought that back.
Well, it sort of didn't go out of style here as much as it did everywhere else, but It was amazing. It just sort of all of a sudden we opened this door and everyone wanted to barter. And everyone had stuff that they wanted to give us that we really needed or were willing to go out and buy it for us even just to then trade with us. One person went out and got about $200 worth of groceries, and I think all I gave her was about 5-gallon bucket of chicken poop.
Well, that sounds like a fair trade to me. But, I wonder if this is a bit of a novelty, at least in this situation. I mean, I'm sure folks know about your experiment and they're enamored with it. I wonder if you continued that for any length of time, if your neighbors would still be buying you $200 worth of groceries.
No, I think it would sort of get a little more even after a while. But it made Lisa and me both realize that we didn't have to keep doing everything the way we'd done it our whole lives and the way everyone else was, and that there was a way to make this work. I think we're actually keep doing this, at least for the next couple of years, just to see if it does help us get rid of the rest of the debt.
So the spending-free experiment ended at the end of September, and I think I read that you found out you had some pent-up spending just waiting to get out. What do you think that was all about?
Well, it ended one day when we had to buy gas to go to Helen, one of my daughter's soccer game. And once that happened, I thought, well, you know, we got to go ahead and get everything we need now. So I went to the grocery store. I held myself in check, but then I saw the Dunkin' Donuts.
Uh-oh.
And we'd given up any kind of like buying coffee all year or anything that you got at a store that was sort of grab and go food. And I hid it, the coffee in the bag under the car seat, but Lisa found it. So, but there was that desire to spend and like just not be controlled and not, you know, not be stopped from getting something. But right after I did it, though, you know, the remorse was like so overwhelming. I couldn't even get out of bed the next morning.
Well, what do you think that is? You know, I think you're a fascinating guinea pig. You know, you've had a long period of deprivation and apparently something was just building in you that you just wanted to go out and spend money. I'm sure a lot of folks can relate to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's I keep looking at and keep trying to examine and keep trying to understand. I haven't figured it out, but we are so trained and so programmed, I think, to buy and to spend. I would love to try to escape or sidestep or at least try to come up with some new way to feel okay and a part of things without, like, getting in debt.
Well, we will look forward to your future stories and to chatting with you again. Hadding Carter, so nice to speak with you, and good luck with the continuing experiment.
Thanks, Tess, but can you pay for the parking meter?
I'd be happy to. When the parents in a family don't speak English, the kids often do the banking, which means big responsibility at a young age.
Hey, I went to the bank yesterday with my mom. What did you do after school? You know, it's not a conversation to have at the playground.
That and more stories of kids and money coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It is time to take more of your questions. With me again is David Lazarus. He's a consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thanks for being here.
Darn tootin'.
I think that's a first for the show.
Okay, then.
Darn tootin'.
Well, setting the bar high.
All right, we've got Sean on the phone in Miami, Florida. How you doing?
Hi, Tess. Hi, David. I'm good.
What's your question for us today?
I had a situation where I rented a car and many months later found out that they made a damage claim.
Oh.
Afterwards. And so my question is, evidently there are many people who've experienced a similar situation where there's a false damage claim, and I don't know what recourse I have in that situation.
David, I returned a rental car yesterday, and every time I return it, I'm like, please God, let it be okay. Let me not get a notice like this from the rental car company 6 months down the line.
Every one of us has had this experience of either being confronted with this prospect or freaking out about being confronted with this prospect.
Yes, from my research, I mean, people are very defensive about this now and, you know, take pictures of the car afterwards and keep all the paperwork for years. This happened to me a year and a half ago, and I recently received a notice in the mail from a bonded attorney in Canada, which is where it happened, saying that if I didn't pay up the $700 plus, they were going to send it to collections and my credit would be negatively affected.
And Sean, first of all, getting a letter like that is terrifying, is it not?
Absolutely.
And the prospect of having a collection agency, quote unquote, capital letters, that also is very scary, is it not?
Yes.
And that's exactly where they want you to be. Deep breath. You can deal with this. Now, first thing you do is when you come out with the rep and the clipboard and you're supposed to do this walk around of the car, do a walk around of the car. I mean, I'll point at every nick, every scratch, every speck of dust, because you can't take their word for it.
Now, I have done that when I pick up the car, but I've never had them come out with a clipboard and a drawing of the car when I return it.
That will happen sometimes. I've had occasions, too, where you just drop it on the express and you're running for the airline terminal.
Yeah.
Again, that was me yesterday.
And they're counting on that. What I advise very strongly is cover yourself. So as you heard about people using their cell phone cameras to record things, record it at the beginning of your trip when you are setting off. And then when you come back and there's just something there that you're a little leery of, you might want to take a snap of that as well. Other than that, though, you're going to get into this he said, she said situation where the car company, the rental car company, is going to be saying no, no, no. And that's a difficult situation to get out of. What you need to do is simply work with these guys. Ignore the lawyer. Contact the car company. Tell them where you're at and show that you're not trying to scam these people.
But in the meantime, what if the collection agency starts to come after her? And how does this affect, for example, her credit report?
These guys, they're all about scaring the bejeepers out of you.
Job well done.
Yes. And remember, there are very clear rules about this, how this kind of thing works. For instance, they're not allowed to harass you. They're not allowed to call you at ungodly hours. They're never allowed to make threats to you. Also, in many states, there's a statute of limitations on how long they have to collect the debt. Find out where you are, what the statute of limitations is as well. They don't want you to know that such a thing exists. It works in your favor.
So that would be whatever the statute is in Canada, then.
Presuming they have one. Canada has a lot of good things, so I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
Can that kind of thing affect my credit here in the U.S.?
It would affect your credit if indeed it moved to the next step, if it escalated to somebody actually suing you, for example, or pressing charges or anything like that. Chances are it's not going to get to that level. And here's the other dirty little secret about collections. The collection agencies will frequently resell people's debt to other collection agencies. And that means that they're just kind of rolling the dice. They're hoping they're going to get a little money. And if they don't, big deal. And so you can remember that the system isn't completely stacked against you, even though they want you to think that it is.
So is this something where she can just make a phone call, or should she be sending, you know, a registered letter so there's proof of interaction?
Correspondence is always going to work better. You want a paper trail. And I would do this. Send it to the CEO.
Okay.
Just go online, find out who the CEO of Avis is, find out the address of the corporate headquarters, and mail a letter to him or her. Break through all the clutter of customer service and get to people who actually can do this job.
Okay.
So, Sean, I guess the lesson from here on out is get out that camera phone.
Yes, absolutely. From now on, I'm on the defensive, or the offensive, or both.
All right.
Okay, thank you guys very much. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Bye-bye. David, that's all the time we've got.
No.
Yes, I'm sorry. But we will have you on again very soon, I'm sure. And we'd love to invite folks to write us with some more consumer questions. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much for coming in.
It was a pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
It's a good day when I get to use a clip from Mad Men. Oh, you're thinking to yourself, something about how advertising helps separate us from our hard-earned dollars. Not this time. Betty, Sally.
Are we rich? It's not polite to talk about money.
So why is it rude to talk about money, even from the comfort of your own home? It's a question we're going to be asking and answering over the next few weeks. Kids and money. How we teach it. What they think of it. All leading up to a special live show in Portland, Oregon next month. We'll start with a mother-daughter pair. Beth Kobliner has joined us before. She is the author of Get a Financial Life, and she's also the mother to three children. Her 13-year-old daughter is in the studio with us. First, welcome back, Beth.
Great to be here.
And I'm so pleased that we're joined by your daughter, Rebecca. Hi.
Hi.
And we wanted to talk a little bit about what it's like to have a mom who's a personal finance expert.
Well, you know, I learned a lot of great things from her. We like to go shopping together. That's sort of our back to school. And actually, it's a lot like what she says about getting a house. You really need to make sure that if you wouldn't buy it at full price, that you wouldn't buy it at a discounted price, because it's not worth getting if you're going to compromise.
You know, it's something we talk about a lot, because when she was little, we'd go into a store and you'd see something and you'd say, oh, it's only a dollar. She wants it. And I would really force myself to have to say no, because she's my firstborn, my only daughter. You know, I wanted to give her these things. And I deprived her.
I'm a very deprived child. Yeah.
But I think it worked out with that notion of, you know what, every time you walk into a store, it doesn't mean you buy something.
Do you remember when your mom first started talking to you about money?
I think I really grew up with it. I learned a little bit. We always got our allowance. We got a dollar a week when we were younger. They said, you know what? So you can buy some of these things yourself now that you have money. Our allowance finally went up. So that's a little better. We now get $5 a week.
I think also not necessarily as a punitive thing, but for example, if she had a book in school, the school library, and she lost it. And I said, look, you know, you're going to have to pay for half of that. And I think that made an impact. What was it the other day you asked me for something and I...
What did you ask for?
Teen Vogue.
Teen Vogue, okay.
And I said, that has to come out of your money.
Do you get any education about money issues in school?
I do think a little bit. We don't actually have an economy class or anything, but there's definitely a lot of back and forth now that times are changing. I find that kids a lot are talking more about it and just sort of comparing prices. Oh, I got this really cheap. You should check out the store and stuff. So that's really nice. I like to see that people are sort of really thinking about what they get.
You think that's an outgrowth of the economic crisis?
Is that
what you mean by things are changing?
I think that actually there's a lot of hope for kids that are going into their 20s and 30s now, because I think now we almost are sort of privileged because we know more about money than I think people who grew up 10 years ago did. I think that we're going to be more responsible when we're going into our 20s and 30s now.
I think that is true. And I think, honestly, people are getting laid off from jobs, and the economy is definitely having a major impact on them. So that has to trickle down to the kids. And while that's very difficult, I think it does end up with some pretty good lessons for people.
As a 13-year-old, I wonder what advice you would have for parents who are wondering how to talk money issues with their kids.
Well, I think what really taught me about money was when my mom and I went shopping together, and she showed me how to find a bargain and evaluate what I really wanted and what I didn't want. I think that really taught me to sort of budget what I want to get and what I want to save. And I have a bank account. I opened a bank account and saved some of my money in there so that I can get interest and buy more later, hopefully. So I would definitely just say there are little steps that you can take and sort of lead by example and showing kids what they can do to make the best of their money.
And not to be afraid about talking about money?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely not. It's a really good experience for me to sort of learn what I can do to sort of make the best of my money.
Yeah, I just remember we went to a flea market a few weeks ago and we walked by something and Rebecca said, oh, I really like that. And I said, let's give it like 30 minutes. Let's walk down the whole flea market and then come back and see if you still want it. And she said, that was really great. And she also said, Mommy, why can't you do that with cookies? Because, and it was brilliant insight. She's like, you know what? That was really useful to me, Mommy, because I would have bought it. Now I really don't think I want it so much.
Well, I think that just the fact that you even talk about budgeting has put you far ahead of most adults. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, some kids learn about money because they have to. In many immigrant families, kids are the only ones with a strong enough grasp of English to interact with the teller at the bank. They act as translators and as family budgeters. Youth Radio's Myra Jimenez is one of those kids, and she recalls her first lessons in money management.
I was 13 when I spoke to a bank teller for the first time. That was 5 years ago. My parents were having money problems. Back then, they didn't speak a lot of English, so I had to translate their questions. Here's my father, José Trinidad.
It was very difficult. You weren't mature enough. You were too small to understand the things we wanted to ask about the house and the bank.
Scholars call this language brokering. That's when children of immigrants translate for their parents. A Pew survey found that only a small minority of Latino immigrants say they speak English well. But almost 90% of their U.S.-born adult children are fluent. Ana Castillo remembers translating for her mom, but she admits being kind of embarrassed about it.
I really couldn't imagine like other children having to do what I was doing, and I feel like it's something that I never talked about when I was growing up. Like, hey, I went to the bank yesterday with my mom. What did you do after school? You know, it's like, it's not a conversation I have at the playground.
Now, Anna can smile about it. She's 26 and works full-time as a community organizer in South LA. But translating caused a lot of stress.
If I made a mistake, my mom would be upset about it afterwards. And just getting picked for that, like that was really hard because I always tried like helping my mom out, and then to have done the opposite, then, you know, that just kind of sucks. But I think in the long run, it still helps. It helped me as an adult because I'm still in that world and still negotiating with people.
It helped me too. Now I understand the basics of banking. I know how to watch an account, and I'm careful about avoiding overdraft fees. But it was hard figuring out complicated transactions for my parents. UCLA professor Marjorie Fauste-Corellana studies the role of young language brokers like me.
It can be really hard for kids, and perhaps even traumatizing, when they see their families being treated unfairly by institutions of the larger society. But they can also feel incredibly powerful, valued, important, doing things that other kids can't do, making a difference.
About a year and a half ago, my parents wanted to buy a house in Texas. I had to translate all the fine print for them. When the house was in escrow, my mom stopped working because of an injury. We lost the house, and in Anna's case, things got bad when her mom's house foreclosed. At the time, Anna wasn't around to help.
In some ways, I try not to feel responsible for what happened to that house because that's when I was in college. So I was 300 miles away from home, so I couldn't help her through that. And so I wonder, had I been in Los Angeles, would it have been different? Would I have helped her to make a better decision along the way?
Having to translate for our families puts young people like Anna and me in a tough spot. But for the health of our family's finances, we need to give our parents a voice.
Youth Radio's Myra Jimenez. We've been asking you, our listeners, for your stories about childhood and money, what your parents taught you or didn't, what you're teaching your kids or not. For most parents, it is trial and error. And this week, we're going to hear from a mom and daughter in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
My name is Bonnie Neville, and I'm Rose's mom.
I'm Rose Newell, and I am 9 years old, soon to be 10.
We started giving Rose an allowance when she turned 6. I decided that we would use it as a money learning tool as opposed to a reward system for chores and things, because it was important to me for her to understand that, you know, as a family member, she had obligations around the house that were different from being, you know, paid for things. We decided to parse it out a little for her because she was so young.
It's $2 every week. That's for my wallet. And then I usually get like $1 for charity and $1 for savings.
When she got her allowance, or when she had a few weeks worth of allowance, she would just want to buy something with her money. It almost didn't matter what it was. She just wanted to spend that money.
Yeah, I saved, I spent, I saved, I spent. And I did that for a while.
And I've noticed recently that she's actually much more thoughtful now about whether it's something that she really wants or whether it's just fun to spend money. But Rose, why don't you, I can think of times that you saved up a lot and did a big spending, one with the guinea pigs.
So I decided that I wanted guinea pigs because you can actually pick them up and they're soft. We did this whole adding thing and we added up all the supplies and everything and it was like $260. I was like, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money. So I did all my bank account, which was like $70, I'd say. And then I had like $40 from two birthday money and Christmas money. And then I had all my allowance, so I saved up for a while. And after a long time, now I've got two happy guinea pigs.
You know, spending money is a part of life, just like saving money. And it's been nice to see her think more about how she wants to spend it.
Bonnie and Rose Neville. We want your stories and your questions about kids and money. Find the link to submit them at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, you may know actor Donald Faison from Scrubs, but I bet you don't know how he handled his first movie paycheck.
I was living at my parents' house still. And instead of moving out of my parents' house, which I could have done, I went out and bought a car.
Now he's teaching kids how not to follow in his famous footsteps. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.